Hi, Adam.
Hi, I
All
assume
right.
it's working.
Yeah, we're good to go. All right. So let's start with your year of graduation, including those spring, summer, fall, and your major or majors.
My God, that was so long ago. What year? So I believe I graduated 2010,
Okay.
with a degree in professional music.
What did
God,
you
it is
walk?
such a blur.
Sure. Do you remember if you finished in the spring? I mean, that's like there's the
I
big.
did finish in the spring, yes.
Okay.
I
And
did
you did
finish in the
pro
spring.
music. Cool. And single major, not a double major.
Yeah, I thought that I wanted to be a CWP major, but I kind of wanted to get out to the real world, so I changed to professional music and kind of got out a bit earlier. I think I graduated in 3 years because I
Oh.
transferred a bunch of credits from high school too.
Oh, impressive. And what was your principal instrument?
Piano.
All right, great. So we will get to your history later. But
Okay.
for now, tell us about your current job. What do you do? Where do you do it?
Okay. So, I am now based in New York City. I'm a partner in the vice president of business operations at a company called Caridia. Caridia is a medical device incubator, which means that we come up with new ideas, new therapies, new technologies, and we get them going. We get them started. We raise money for them. We build a prototype. We test it out in animals and early human studies, and then ideally an acquirer comes along and purchases it and brings it to the people.
Now, would you say, I'm curious because you said I heard the term incubator and I've heard that before. Usually, would I hear that, would I've heard incubator before and it's been for tech firms? The
Yes.
idea was that there would be individuals out there somewhere in the world who would come up with the first idea and then they'd come to the incubator who would work with them to get it to the next level. Is that what you're doing, or are you all actually coming up with that initial idea?
So the majority of the ideas have come from Mark Gelfand and Howard Levin, who are the two founders of Caridia. Most of the ideas have been internal. Some
Gotcha. So that's
have
a different
been
model.
licensed. Yeah. I mean, some of the ideas have been licensed from universities. Sometimes, a lot of times, professors in their research come up with amazing ideas, but don't have the tools they need in order to push them forward. So we have taken projects like that as well, especially from Johns Hopkins University. When there's an idea that's really amazing, they'll come to us and we will help them raise money and kind of build out a team and get it done.
Gotcha. What was your title again?
Vice President of Business Operations.
Got it.
So
And yeah.
specifically, what do I do?
Actually, I was going to ask quickly about
Oh, go ahead.
Carita. Like, about how many employees are we talking?
So this it's a bit complicated. So Caridia itself has only 8 employees.
Okay.
Then once we are able to raise money for an idea, that company gets spun off from Caridia and becomes a new entity that has its own employees, but it's still owned and managed by Caridia. So right now, Caridia has 8 companies that we own and manage and basically control. And each of those companies has between 4 and 8 employees. And then between those companies, we share 40 to 50 consultants. So if you really kind of put it all
So
together,
850 or 100, depending on how we measure it, right?
it's about 100 at the end of the day.
Gotcha. That's an interesting structure. And but you're with that core company, Caridia
Yeah,
itself.
I stay with the core company.
Gotcha. And to get to this later, but really quick, do you have medical background knowledge, or did you sort of end up in this?
No, I had absolutely none going into this.
It's all good, man. I'm a non-musician teaching at Berkeley.
I'm sure that's very interesting for you too.
So cool. Now let's go into your role as the vice president of business operations. What is it that mm-hmm. you do? What's your responsibility there?
So since it's such a small company, it's basically a constant startup. And my role is to do everything that the founders don't want to do or are not interested in doing. So that's everything from, you know, HR, setting up payroll, finding an office, setting up the offices, to handling the details of fundraising, handling all the legal issues that come up when you're closing a deal. I manage all the budgets for every company. I build new budgets. I track to all of them. And just everything that is the business part of what we do, I take care of. And everything that's engineering or science is done by the three other partners at Caridia.
Gotcha. Did you say the three other partners? So you're considered one of the four partners?
Yes.
Very cool. And let's see, do you directly like manage/supervise people?
Yes.
You do? Yeah. So who would be your underlings?
So in our office, I have an assistant, an office manager, and an accountant/bookkeeper.
Gotcha. Okay, very cool. I'm sure it varies, but you did mention startup thing. About how many hours a week do you work?
Oh, wow. Probably on average 70.
It's intense.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I mean, I travel 80 to 100 days a year.
Interesting. I would have thought that a business manager would stay local. Are these other businesses not based in New York then?
No, they're not. So the fundraising part of the job actually requires the most travel.
Would you say what you call fundraising, most of us, I assume, would call venture capital?
Yeah, venture capital. Mm-hmm. We raise money from venture capital. We raise money from strategics. Those are the large companies, the Boston Scientific, Abbott, Medtronic. And we also have government grants. But the traveling part is for the venture capital. We raise a lot of money in China. So I go to China 3 or 4 times a year.
Interesting.
We have an office in Santa Clara, California, in Silicon Valley. So I'm there once a month about.
God, is this like an office which has some of those subsidiary companies then?
Yeah, we park all of our engineering out in California. Okay. That's where all the best engineers are. So we just got a facility out there and we park our companies there until they're to the point where they can have their own office and they need that kind of space.
And I'm sorry, created, do you say, are they making like medical devices or are we talking like pharmaceuticals?
Only medical devices. We do not do pharmaceuticals.
Understood. All right. So, let's see. I was hoping so sometimes you're out traveling, you're meeting with investors. I assume you're trying to raise investment money for a specific device you want to manufacture.
Yeah.
Yeah, they get some amount of equity, you get some money, and it goes forward.
Yeah, exactly.
Just curious, does your company keep some fraction of the equity with these new businesses?
So we have founder shares. So in the beginning, we own 100% of the company, and then as we raise more and more money, we own less and less of the company. But we hold on to equity even when we are not as involved, because later on we like to hire a CEO to run it, to bring it to acquisition. But we still hold equity at that point.
Understood. And let's say the days that you're not out there, I'll do a couple things. Could you tell me, like, what goes into a typical meeting with a venture capital or strategic firm? If you could take us through, like, what one of those meetings might be like, what do you have to do before it and then during and after?
Sure. So the first meeting is usually a non-confidential meeting where we give a very high level view of what we're trying to do, mm-hmm. how much money we're trying to raise, what milestones we'll hit on the first round of money raised. And we'll talk about the market. The device always has to meet a major unmet need, which means, a problem that doesn't have a solution right now, or the solution is not good enough. You're basically just, you're selling to these people. Mm-hmm. You need to show them why this idea is worth risking their investors' money. Because, these guys don't have a job. They don't have a fund unless they return on their first fund.
Right.
So you need to show them why this company is going to be acquired and why it has a good chance of working and a good chance of getting sold.
Gotcha. And then what's the next step?
After that, you sign an NDA and you give them, usually they go into diligence. So they'll ask a bunch of very specific questions. Usually they have consultants that are key opinion leaders in the field. And they will just pepper you with any question that they can possibly find that would make them not want to invest. And you need to give them answers. You need to be prepared with an answer to any question that they have. For two reasons. One, it shows that you have a solid product. And two, it shows that you're on top of your game and ready to spend their money that they're investing in a way that's going to move this product towards acquisition and towards the market.
Gotcha. And what's a typical cycle between, let's say, that first meeting and if everything goes well and you get that investment money?
Every deal is so different. We just closed on a deal that took us 2 years to raise this amount of money on. Mm-hmm. And that one had there's just a million things that could happen. This one had a really complicated capitalization table. It had a bunch of control issues in the closing document between the VCs and strategics investing that we had to sort out and find a way that they could all agree. It was crazy. And then if we're talking about a deal in China, a lot of times there are complicated company structures that have to be set up. Usually, a Cayman entity on top that owns a U.S. entity. The Cayman entity also owns a Hong Kong entity that owns a China entity. And basically, at the end of the day, every single deal has its own very unique set of challenges.
Sure.
And kind of that's what makes it fun and also gives me an advantage, because while some of these issues do repeat themselves throughout the deals, a lot of them are new, especially when it comes to China. And when there's something new, the key thing is, and that I'm fortunate to have, is I'm a problem solver and I'm a creative problem solver. So I don't get scared when I hear, oh, we can only invest in RMB, the Chinese currency. We can't invest in US dollar, and we can't own equity in a company outside of China, because that's how the laws of China work right now. And so I say, okay, let me get back to you. And there are ways to make it so they can invest in RMB into a Chinese subsidiary and give them the option to stock their swap their stock for Cayman stock at the point of acquisition. And there's a million little things that happen like that that you just need to be creative with and patient with to find a solution, to find a way for people to be able to invest in you.
Gotcha. So let's take it to, let's say, the two-thirds-ish of the time that you're not on the road meeting with investors. What can you take us through, like, what's a typical day at the office that you're not doing the venture capital stuff? Or a typical week if the day is very too much.
Yeah, everything does vary a lot. I will tell you what I do every day. I use a software called Asana. It's a project management software. And I spend a lot of my time putting out fires in our 8 portfolio companies. Whether that's putting out fires as in a problem, or solving some employment issue or budget issue, or there's some confusion on what this person's supposed to be doing and this person's supposed to be doing. Or oftentimes a big chunk of my day gets spent on diligence, just answering financial questions that come in when we're raising money. But it's tricky because everything kind of comes in waves. Right now we are, and for the past 3 months, all I have been doing is fundraising, closing deals, and answering diligence questions. So that's what comes to the top of my mind. And what that means is travel, a lot of calls with lawyers, and lawyers are just explaining all of these, you know, very specific words that are used that could mean several things, and it's kind of ridiculous, but it's a game that is played in venture capital for people to get more control over a deal. That's what I'm doing a lot of right now is in diligence, answering questions on budget, answering questions on structure, on cap tables and that kind of stuff. But I mean, when that's not going on, the core of my job was supposed to be, and still is, kind of managing budgets and financials for every single company.
Gotcha.
Which is probably the most important thing that I actually do. I need to know exactly where we're at in every single company, when we're going to cash zero, when we need to start raising money, and where that money is going at any time.
Understood. Interesting. So, by the way, because you mentioned being a partner, again, I don't want a number here, but I'm a little bit curious as to, like, what's the structure of your compensation? Are you on salary? Does partner mean you get some share of the profits? Is it like moderate salary, large bonus? You know, do you get X percent of venture capital you raise? Like, how does that all work?
Sure. We do not get a percent of venture capital that we raise. Although in a way we do, because the Caridia charges we charge our portfolio companies similar to how a law firm or an accounting firm charges its clients. We charge them hourly for the partners and for the employees of Caridia. But the structure of mine is I have a salary, a bonus, and I have equity in Caridia, which has equity in all of our portfolio companies. So I have equity in all of our portfolio companies.
Gotcha. So if any of those do really well, you'll do really well.
Yeah. And I'd say, what is interesting about how we function at Caridia is that the four partners all own a percentage of the company. Mm-hmm. And our bonus or our profit share is based on the company's profit at the end of that year. We split it based on our equity ownership. But the thing that is a bit unique to us is when I, and especially happened when I was earlier days, if we have more rough years, I will make less than what my salary is. And it's just based on the percent of the company that I own. So we would pay the other employees, but the partners would not get paid as much. That's the structure that we've set up. So we are, the four of us are taking a risk. Thank God things are going well right now, but if they don't go well, we will keep working for a lower salary.
Gotcha. I understand. Interesting.
So we all function as business owners, basically, at the end of the day.
Sure. I'm a little curious, because I try to decide where to slot you in terms of the category you work in. I'm tempted to say finance, since you're always meeting with venture capital people. It's either that or administration. Which one do you think is more appropriate?
It's finance.
It's finance. Do you have, yeah. I know a lot of people who work in finance have, you know, various certifications. They call, you know, the Section 73s or something. Do you have any official, like, financial certifications?
I do not.
Okay, because those might be more for the brokers.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I do know that over the past 3 or 4 years, there have been a few times where it has been brought up that I don't have an MBA, and some people would like to see that. Interesting. What I ended up doing is I'm actually in a master's program now for biotechnology management and entrepreneurship.
Cool.
At Yeshiva University in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I looked into the MBA route, and it wasn't for me.
Sure. Seems like if you know what you're doing, a more specialized degree can be appropriate.
Yeah, I put a ton of thought into it, and I talked with a bunch of people, and it seems like this is best for me, so I can start. I mean, the areas that I'm really weak on are science and engineering. I don't have any education. I never learned it. So now in this master's, I'm diving into the science part of this industry.
Gotcha. And, you must be doing that very part-time if you're working 70 hours a week, but how many years is it going to take you to get that degree, and how many have you done?
So I actually just started last week.
Okay.
I have not mapped out how long it will take yet, because I'm taking one class this semester. I'm going to see how I handle it, and then I'll kind of figure out how many classes I want to take in future semesters.
Sure, that makes sense.
But
it's what,
actually,
like 12 is a little like 12 classes, or
yeah, so it's 12 classes. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting and something that stuck with me is the I believe the Caridia, whatever it's called, logo. What's that? The saying is to be rather than to seem. What's that called?
For a company motto, that's Berkeley's one, right?
Yeah.
To be Berkeley's, I should know that. I could say motto.
I don't know. But what's interesting about it is I've been doing this for seven years now. Mm-hmm. But I always felt like I was just seeming, honestly. And not actually really understanding the work that I was doing.
Sure.
The way I got into it was a total strange story.
Yeah, we will totally go into that in a few minutes.
But yeah, I felt like I didn't understand it as well as I understand music or other things. So it's time, I felt it's time for me to understand the science and get to what my eventual goal is to run these companies. And I'd like to be a CEO of a medical device company or a drug delivery company. That would be a total dream. I like what I do now. I like being a producer. I
gotcha.
Like putting pieces together and making it happen.
Interesting. Very cool. So along those lines, let's even say for your current career, be the VP of business ops or the kind of business administration stuff you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Can you articulate, because one of the criteria you had to hit for this interview is that you like what you do.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about this field that you enjoy?
I am a producer. What's cool is that I work with creatives who have a vision, and I help them make it happen. I did the same thing, when I graduated Berkeley. I spent 4 years mainly producing artists, and I like working with creative people who don't like getting into the weeds and the details of how to actually make something happen. And I always work really well with creatives because I am a creative, so I get it. But I'm also a get stuff done kind of person. So basically I'm really doing the same thing I was doing before. I mean, obviously there's more finance and there's more, you know, there's all the lingo and it's a different process, but at the end of the day, I'm working with creatives to help them do amazing things.
Gotcha.
And that's what I think I'm supposed to do on this planet.
Understood. All right. So, hey, let's take it back now to 2010. Although if you mm-hmm. feel that the story is a logical earlier starting point, we can go back further. I mean, guessing you're not thinking business ops at a medical company, equipment company, could be wrong. Put us like in your headspace as things were wrapping up Berkeley and kind of what you were thinking and what you were doing. And then we'll take it one step at a time from there to where you are now.
Sure. So when I graduated Berkeley, I wanted to be a recording artist. I wanted to start a movement where people would kind of think about their lives more and think about what's going on around us and just look at things more critically. I wanted to write music that would make people slow down and look around.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to create this big social change where people will look at our government and we'll look at, you know, income inequality and gender inequality and race, you know, everything that's going on and really start thinking about it.
Short list of things to fix.
So I wanted to do that through music, kind of the, like the 60s again today.
Okay,
and I still think we're kind of due for it. I think we might be, I think I was a little early on it. I didn't think things would get this ridiculous as we've got recently. And the more ridiculous we get, the more likely that something like this is going to happen.
Sure.
But yeah, so when I was graduating Berkeley, I wanted to do that and mm-hmm. I moved to New York City.
But are you from the New York area?
I'm from upstate New York, Binghamton, New York.
That's not particularly close to the city.
No, it's 3 hours, 3.5 hours drive.
Gotcha. So you moved to the city. Cool. What was your plan to like pay the rent and all that?
I had a friend from Jewish summer camp mm-hmm. who did something called she was a teaching artist in New York City, which means that she would go to low-income neighborhoods with schools that had to cut their music programs and create after-school music programs like twice a week, whether it's a musical or a chorus or a bunch of different stuff. Whatever you could do, they could use it.
Okay, so you have a friend who's doing this. So what, did she offer you a job doing this?
Yeah, I probably should have said that. Yeah, so she offered me a job doing that, and she also had an off-Broadway show at the Public Theater that she offered me to be the musical director of.
Nice.
So she really set me up when I moved to New York and made it so I could pay the rent. Barely, but I could pay the rent.
Cool.
Actually, my first day in New York, I went to the school for an interview. It was that quick. And I got my first job at a middle school in the Bronx.
Fantastic. So All right, so there you are. You're barely making ends meet, doing this like music education stuff, being the musical director. Are you working on your own project at this point? Because it sounded like that was also.
I'm writing a bit, and I'm just putting myself out there, learning the city and learning how the music industry works here. Trying to get more schools. I was only in one school at that point, and I knew that I would have to get at least two in order to really make this sustainable.
Sure.
So eventually I did. But then actually something unexpected happened, in that I was playing a gig one night at a Italian restaurant, and a guy came up to me and he said, I really like the way you play and sing. It's great. What are your goals?" And I told him, and he was like, "I'm a manager. Let's talk." I met with him the next week, and a few times after that. And he said, "Listen, I want to manage you. I want to develop you as an artist. Why don't you go live in my house in Los Angeles? You could be by yourself. There's a grand piano there, and write your album. And when it's ready, I'll come out there, play it for me, and then we'll see where things go."
Wow,
And
that's exciting.
yes, I was like, okay.
And he offered you a place to live too.
So I lived in a house with an amazing view in the Hollywood Hills in Los Angeles, with a piano, but no car, which in Los Angeles is a real odd thing.
A
And
quick check in. How long were you in New York till this happened?
I was only in New York for, I think, 5 months when this
Okay.
happened. So I moved out to LA for 6 weeks or 8 weeks, and wrote the album. My parents had no idea. They just didn't understand what I was doing, but that's okay. I wrote the album out there. Unfortunately, there was no Uber, or maybe fortunately there was no Uber. So I was stuck in this house. And I would walk around, and cars would drive by and think I was so weird, because people don't walk around in LA, especially not in the Hollywood Hills. That happened.
Sure.
I wrote the album, and he came back, and I played the album for him, and he thought it was too depressing. And I was like, "Oh man, this isn't gonna work." He's like, "Why don't you write more upbeat stuff?" I was like, "Oh no." So we went our ways. I came back to New York pretty depressed and freaking out about what I was gonna do. And oddly, at that time, right when I got back, I got an email from an old friend from Berkeley saying, "Hey, I have a pretty big budget to record an album. I want to come to New York and do it. Will you produce it?"
Okay.
And produce and write it. And I had never produced anything. And I mean, I'd written for other people, but not really. But I mean, I needed the money, one, and two, it was a really cool opportunity. It had a big budget. So we went to Avatar Studios and recorded an album. And it was freaking amazing. I mean, that was my first album I produced, and got to go to Avatar, which
Nice.
Berkeley now owns. And
What?
so that is how I started producing
So
for
you've
money.
produced one decent budget album. Now you're thought of as a producer, basically.
I mean, yeah, that's kind of how everything's gone. You do one, and you learn, and then after the second one, you're an expert.
How did you get your next producing gig after the first one ended? How long, I'm gonna flaunt my musical ignorance here, like how long are you spending on this first album?
Spent about 4 months
Okay.
writing and recording. And during that, another friend from Jewish summer camp, she saw that I was recording at Avatar Studios and producing this big album. So she reached out to me and said, "Let's work together."
Well, it sounded
And
like Jewish summer camp was your best career move.
I'm sending my kid there for sure. My wife really doesn't want to send him there. We have an 8-month old.
Gotcha.
But he's going. He's going. It made my career. And actually, I'll tell you in a bit, it actually was the way I got to where I am now. But yeah, so that artist is called Do Paulo. Mm-hmm. And we recorded a bunch of stuff together, and it did well. It led to recording a song with Bon Iver out in where were we? Wow. Where was that? And near Minneapolis. I can't really. Oh, Eau Claire. We went to his house in Eau Claire and recorded an album, which was a dream. And from there, the working with Do Paulo led to a bunch of other production gigs. So I had, you know, a decent career going as a producer. I was also doing the schools at the same time.
Gotcha. That sounds like you're living the musical dream here. Well, I mean, other than your own stuff, not good out, but beyond that, you're, you know, working in music and holding your own in New York. That's great.
Yeah. So that it was cool. And I was starting things. I was actually starting to build recording studios in these schools that had to cut their music programs. They had enough money to build these kind of makeshift recording studios so the kids could write and record, which was amazing because these, you know, it's rough the way some of them, a lot of them are growing up. I went to a school where 25% of the student population was actually living in shelters.
Wow.
And so they have a lot to say, and their outlets are not that great in those neighborhoods. So setting up recording studios was really cool. It gave them a way to write music, and I started songwriting programs in schools. And this is all while producing. And so, yeah, I was living the musical dream in New York City, for sure.
Sure. You said this went on for about 4 years, or close to.
Yeah. Yeah, it was about 4 years since I had graduated Berkeley, that this was all going on. 3 to 4 years, because there was a year of overlap between what I'm doing now and what I was doing at the time.
Sure. I'm kind of curious because, of course, this sounds like a great musical career, and had you kept doing this, you and I would not be having this conversation now.
Right.
So what put you on this different path here? What changed? What made you want to do something else? Well, genuine, not rhetorical question.
No, yeah. What happened was, yes, I was doing great in music. Things were going really well. But at the end of the day, I was still making like 30 grand a year.
That's tough, and even tougher if you're in New York.
Yeah. I mean, I could not live the life that I really wanted on that. It wasn't sustainable, which I wasn't thinking about at that time, but I mean, I really wanted big success in music from producing huge artists and having Billboard top hits, and I wasn't lucky in that. And I thought I was writing music towards that, but it wasn't happening. And maybe it would have happened if I would have kept it. Who knows? But what did happen is when I moved to New York, I had the goal of getting my own apartment and being able to afford renting my own apartment. And I achieved that goal. And my next goal was to travel the world. I grew up middle class. We didn't travel far away anywhere. And I wanted to see the world. I always did. So this is how the shift happened. I got an offer in the mail for a credit card, which gave 20,000 points. And I said, oh, that's interesting. What are these? I know these points are for travel. I've heard people talk about it. Like, what is it? So I started Googling it, and I just dove deep, deep, deep down the rabbit hole of credit card points and airline miles and hotel points. And I read about it for a month, and I studied it like crazy. And then I took out 10 credit cards, and I met sign-up bonuses for these credit cards by doing something. It used to be a thing. They blocked it and shut down all that stuff now, and I don't do it at all. But there used to be a way to basically buy gift cards, or debit cards, prepaid debit cards, and then use those debit cards, and you could buy the debit cards with a credit card at office supply stores or at Duane Reade or CVS, and then you could write checks from those debit cards. So basically you were using a credit card, and then you could even write a check to yourself to pay off that credit card.
That's so weird.
Yeah, it was.
So that meant in theory you could pay your balance in full every month, even though you still have never paid the balance.
Exactly. So that is how someone making $30,000 a year could meet, you know, $100,000 of credit card spend needed to get the sign up bonus. And I did that.
That's brilliant. Know,
and I did it in a bunch of ways. I also, like, anything friends or my parents needed, expensive things they had to buy, I would say, can I buy it on my credit card? And then you just get cash. Whenever I was – I also had two more pretty large budget production things at that time. So I could pay all the musicians and everyone by check from these debit cards, which is really by credit card. The studio went on my credit card.
And you did all this to – this was for airline miles?
Yeah, this is for credit card – yeah, credit card miles, gotcha. Which can be transferred over to airline miles. And so I was obsessed, and I get really obsessed about things. And I then took those points, and I traveled the world in first class and for free. And I stayed at five-star hotels, and I went all over. I mean, I went to France, Italy, Switzerland, Russia, Korea twice, Japan twice.
Incredible. This one big trip or just lots of different trips?
No, lots of trips. I took my girlfriend, who's now my wife. We went to Ireland, and we went to Paris, and we stayed at this hotel that would have been $1,200 a night, but it was free. And it was hilarious because I was totally broke. I mean, all my money was going to rent. But I was flying in first class, and these tickets that would have been $14,000, and I was staying at hotels that were $1,200 a night. We couldn't afford any food, like nice food. You just get cheese and a baguette, but it was great because we were traveling, and it was what I wanted to do.
That's incredible.
It was really, really cool. And I would post pictures, and I would show people these planes, and they were so interested in it. So I said, and everyone was asking me about it. So I said, okay, I'm going to start a blog where I show people it. It'll be easier to share my story. And from that, I fell into the world of affiliate marketing of credit cards. Because when people click on a link to sign up for a credit card on your blog, you know, you make between $40 and $150 if they're approved.
Wow.
So then that whole kind of part of my life, I said, oh, okay, if I can make money on affiliate marketing, how else can I turn this into a business? Mm-hmm. So what I decided was I would start a consulting company. And that consulting company, small businesses or individuals could hire me to revamp their credit card wallet and also to book flights using their points that they don't know how to use.
What do you mean revamp their credit card wallet? It's just terminology.
Just take a look. Take a look at what cards they have and what they're spending their money on, and show them, okay, if you're spending the majority of your money on restaurants, then you should have this card because it gets 3x points on restaurants instead of what you have right now that's giving you 1% cash back.
Gotcha.
And with these 3x points on restaurants, you can actually get 4 or 5 cents per dollar if you book a business class flight to Europe.
Gotcha.
So just maximizing their spend.
And are you're still doing music during this time?
Yes,
your last year of the music thing?
No. There's about 2 years of this.
I'm curious, like, when did your blog start happening? You graduated college in 2010.
So it was probably around 2013.
Okay, cool. And you start this sort of, I assume, sort of part-time consultancy thing. Can I ask what your rate was?
I was charging $250 to book flights for people. And I did not ever figure out a rate for a small business to hire me, because my first client was the ex-boyfriend of the woman whose off-Broadway musical I was musical directing, who was my friend from summer camp, who gave me my first jobs when I came to New York.
Sure.
And that first client is Mark Gelfand, who is the founder of Caridia.
Oh, so you help him with this stuff. I guess was he the ex at the time? Or
No, they were together at the time. But
So the then boyfriend of your friend who had gotten you some jobs, you did this thing helping him with credit cards.
Yeah. I booked one flight, actually for his business partner Howard, but he introduced me. But I booked one flight, and I did what I normally do, which is I gave him all the options clearly. I told him which seat was the best. I mean, this is my first client, so I'm making sure I nail this, because it's, you know, reputation is everything. I know that from being a producer. Sure. I want to do this perfect. So I found the best seat on the plane. I set that up for him. I told him which lounge to go to. I arranged transportation to and from the airport for him. I had everything super organized. Mm-hmm. And he came back from the trip really happy, and he asked to meet me. And I said, sure. So I went out to lunch with Mark and Howard, the two founders of Caridia.
And Caridia already existed at that time.
Yeah, so short background, because it's kind of important. Caridia, Mark and Howard are serial entrepreneurs. They've come up with some pretty major intellectual property and inventions over the past 20 years. Okay. And recently they had come up with this thing called renal denervation. And it was put into a company called Ardian, which was acquired for $1.2 billion, which was a huge exit in medical devices. I mean, just like unheard of, huge.
That's incredible.
So because of that, yeah, it was really big. So because of that, Mark and Howard said, okay, it's time to grow this business. And we want to take on more projects. We want to do more, because when you're a winner, everyone wants to be next to you. So yep. Now everyone wants to invest, and everyone wants to pitch their ideas and whatever. So anyway, so I went out to lunch with them. Mm-hmm. And they said, Adam, we want you to be our office manager for Caridia. And I said, I don't do that, but thank you. They said, you can work from wherever you want. You don't have to come into the office. And you can manage all the books, all the finance stuff, and just manage all our travel logistics. And I said, I'll continue to do the travel stuff, but I'm not an office manager. I don't have those skills. I don't really want to do it. It's just not me. And they said, we'll get you a computer. You'll work from wherever. You don't have to come into the office. You can work from the beach of wherever. We know you like to travel. You can keep doing that. And we'll pay you $2,500 a month in cash. And I said,
which is,
well,
I just did some math, that's equal to what you'd been earning.
Right, which meant that I could double my income, because they also said I could keep my job and keep doing the schools and whatever. They said, this is a part-time thing. As long as I get my job done, then everything is fine. So, and they said, if it doesn't work out, you know, after a month, no hard feelings. That's that, and we'll move on. So that was, you know, 6 or 7 years ago. An interesting thing happened. Yeah. I found that I've always known I really like numbers. And so I had a fun time learning QuickBooks and how to budget for things and how to track money and cash flow and dry wells and all that fun stuff. And then I also found this thing called Opportunity, which I just wasn't used to. I had opportunities in music and in these schools, but I was working really hard and producing a lot of artists, and they weren't getting anywhere because they had no opportunity. And since they didn't have it, I didn't have it. And I wanted a hit song. I wanted to be really successful.
Sure.
And what I found at Caridia is that if I worked harder and learned more things, I had every opportunity in the world at this company. I could learn anything. If I wanted to learn the legal, the details of legal stuff and closing deals, I could do that. And I did do that. And I became more valuable to Caridia. If I wanted to learn the whole process of finding a medical idea and licensing out the IP and making sure that all consultants are assigning all of their new inventions to the portfolio company, and then the process of going from an idea on the back of a napkin to putting it into a human being and improving their life, I could learn all of that.
When you say learn, did you mean on your own time, or would somebody teach you this stuff? What was the learning process and how you learned all this?
Mark and Howard were extremely generous with me and basically said, if you want to do something, go out there and find an expert, hire them as a consultant, do it side by side the first time, and you'll learn it. And then always keep them as an advisor for future deals. And so, you know, the first year when I was learning QuickBooks, we had a consultant. I called him all the time. He was in the books. He would change things. He would tell me what I was doing wrong. And then one day I said, okay, I can do this now. Let's retain you as a very part-time consultant. And I'll call you when I need help. And they let me do that with everything. I do that with lawyers. I did that with, I don't even know what else. It's been crazy.
Wow. So they did. And can I ask, you said started part-time, what, like a half-time job?
It really wasn't defined.
How much time were you putting in initially?
I was probably putting in 10 to 20 hours a week.
And then like 1 year later, or let's say 6 months after that, how much time were you putting in? I'm curious kind of this trajectory of when did you transition to a more serious, you know, full-time, hey, this is the opportunity.
So 6 months in, or 6 or 8 months in, they sat me down and they said, Adam, you're doing a great job. I said, thanks. They said, okay, so either you're going to be in this or you're not going to do it. So we want this to be what you're doing. We want you to stop in the schools. You can continue producing music in your free time, but you can't do the schools anymore because we need you committed during the day. Still don't have to come into an office, but we need you totally committed to Caridia. And they basically asked me to go full time, 40 hours a week, and gave a significant raise, very significant raise. And I couldn't, there's just no way to turn that down.
Sure. Sure. Was that when you became partner?
No.
How did that happen?
That just happened last year. I mean, that happened from 4 years of me growing and learning all the things that honestly Mark and Howard just don't want to do. And I became invaluable to Caridia because I can work with creatives and not frustrate them, but still get things done.
Gotcha. Gotcha. They saw you. So, all right, so it sounds like pretty much what after the same months where they said, hey, go full time, here's a bunch of money, and you're like, okay then. And then it's been just sort of like continual growth from there.
Yeah. You know, since then there's been a few areas that we kind of pioneered together. Which, so one was fundraising in China. They had never raised money in China before. So we went out there and and we learned how to do it and how to structure it.
Sure.
The cool thing about these guys is they're not only inventors of medical devices, they're also inventors of new ways to do business. And they're always changing, and then they're flexible with how they operate. So I am too. And that's given us the ability to grow together as a company. So one was this China fundraising thing, which has been incredible. Mm-hmm. And the other is we have been applying for and getting government grants, which is a pretty difficult business to understand, but we are starting to really get it. And we've gotten over $3 million in government grants in the past 2.5 years, and we're continuing to apply for them. So that's going well.
That's real money.
It's real money. And it helps us keep this business going in times when venture capital slows down, which does happen.
Got it. All right. And here you are. So let's move on to the third part of the interview of three.
Sure.
So my next first question for you, and let's say there's no right or wrong answer, is these days, what, if anything, is your current relationship with music?
So I still produce one or two albums a year.
Mm-hmm.
And
can I ask, do you make much money doing that, or is it volunteer?
I make a bit. Okay. Not like when I was doing it full time, obviously, but it's still a nice side business for me, and cool. It's something I really enjoy.
Uh-huh.
And actually, we just got a piano in our apartment, so I finally have a piano back in my apartment after years of not having that. So hopefully I'm going to get playing a bunch. I've gotten a bit rusty. But I do miss doing music as much as I used to, and hopefully one day I'll get back to it. We'll see.
Very fair. But you're still keeping keeping a foot in there, so to speak.
Of course. I have to. Okay. It's a big part of who I am.
Awesome. So next question for you is, let's say, obviously you did music, were holding your own, didn't pay great, got almost sort of had your entrepreneur side, and then that quickly got you sucked into this business where you showed really a lot of initiative and grew a lot in your career. It's fantastic. There are other people out there who are, you know, I'm sure a lot of companies have vice presidents of business ops. Most of them did not go to Berkeley or to music school.
Right.
So let's say you've alluded to some of this before, but in terms of communicating with creatives, beyond that, is there anything else you feel your Berkeley experience did particularly well to prepare you for what you're doing now?
You know, I was thinking about this because I knew it was going to be a question. I've been thinking a lot about it. I will say this whole kind of theme of opportunity. See, even at Berkeley, I was not the top piano player. I couldn't get into those elite ensembles. I know there are opportunities at Berkeley, but I didn't, in my mind, get the opportunities that I really wanted to, of being that recording artist in the studio or being up on stage on a singer showcase or whatever. So kind of what Berkeley trained me is that when an opportunity comes, you give it your all and you maximize it. And that was definitely not a direct thing at Berkeley, but it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely got that from school. And, you know, I don't know. when I was at Berkeley, I was really focused in maximizing the opportunity of being at the school, of you know, using all the resources, and I spent a lot of time in the CWP lab just asking questions on how to use Digital Performer, which is stupid software, and you know, Logic and Pro Tools, and all the instruments inside and all the plugins. I maximized that, and because I did that, I don't know what kind of what I really took away from that in my normal career. Yeah, because I don't know. I think about this, like, what did Berkeley do for where I'm at today? Because I treated Berkeley like a trade school, which might have been the wrong way to treat it. I went there to learn a skill. I learned that skill, and then I ended up not using it for my full time job. I don't know what that. I don't know what it all means, though. Really, I don't. I'm sorry, I don't really have a great answer.
No, it's all. No, it's a very honest answer, and I appreciate that. So, well, let's turn the question around then, because, as you say, Berkeley, a lot of people do figure it's a trade school. It certainly gives one and only one degree, a Bachelor of Music,
right?
And you went there knowing that. You've obviously done very well for yourself here. But all that said, when you look back at your Berkeley education, is there anything where you say, oh, hey, it would have been really useful to have learned this while I was at Berkeley, and they could have taught it to me, and they didn't? Anything missing or incomplete?
I think, honestly, it would have been helpful to understand basic finance, honestly, and how to manage yourself outside of school. I didn't know anything about tax. I know there was a course on that. I think it really should be mandatory. I didn't understand tax and bank accounts even, and just like basic finance stuff, budgets, expenses. And I know there was a course when I was there, and I should have taken it, I guess. But that's super important. You can't function in the world without that, unless you're like this rare superstar that immediately has someone else managing that, which happens rarely.
If it's a course that everybody truly needs, then it should be requirements, not an elective.
And I really think it is. More so than art history, which was an awesome class. I really enjoyed it. But like, I didn't need that when I left. I needed to understand how to handle my money. And maybe just a basic course on like,
can I just
how
ask,
to, oh, go ahead.
When you say finance, I just want to make it clear. Are you talking about your personal finances, as any musician is going to have to deal with paying their rent? Are you talking finance more from like a business point of view? Or both?
I mean, they're kind of, when you're self-employed and have your own business, they're kind of connected. It's like if you write a song and you get really lucky and you get it put on a TV show or whatever, and you get a check for $5,000, you don't go and spend $5,000 on a new guitar. yeah, that's basic, right?
Right.
But it's not. Like, people don't understand that of that $5,000, you might owe $2,000 of it to taxes, depending on what you're making the rest of the year and blah, blah, blah. But I didn't understand taxes when I graduated. I thought, oh, you only pay tax if you make a lot of money, which is somewhat true. A lot of, you know, you should make over $30,000, but still, I didn't understand it at all.
Sure.
It would have really helped.
Got it. That makes sense. So were you going to add something else, or is that good?
Yeah. I think the other thing that I learned, and I'm not totally sure how this could be taught, but I did witness a lot of Berkeley grads from my time there just didn't know how to work for someone. And I understand that it's like a thing where a person's like, oh, I'm never going to work for anyone else. That doesn't exist, though, anywhere. If you own a business, you work for your customer. if you're raising venture money, you work for your board, you work for your investor. And if you work directly for a person, then you work for that person.
Sure.
But I think that a lot of Berkeley grads and me in the beginning and maybe still today, struggle with the idea of working for another person and just they're not good at it. I don't know what that is, but there's something there. You have to understand how to work for a company and how to be a team player and that you're not always going to be the star. I don't know if Berkeley's changed. I mean, I know Berkeley's changed since I went. I mean, that was a decade ago. But at the time I was going, I was very focused on being a star, not about building a career in music.
Gotcha. Gotcha. No, that's very interesting. All right. So next question for you is, let's say, you know, you were doing the music thing for a while that kind of almost accidentally initially got on this other path, but found you really liked it. Let's say that there's a decent number of recent Berkeley grads who maybe are struggling and haven't yet found that path. Mm-hmm. And also people perhaps in their last year at Berkeley staring out into the big scary world, like, oh my God, what's going to happen next? So for either or both of those groups, what advice do you have?
Oof. Oh, man. Honestly, that's tough. It's tough. I think you just go out there and you look for opportunities. It doesn't have to be in music. It could be anything. And if you get that magic moment where you found an opportunity and you happen to really enjoy it, then put everything into it. It doesn't matter if it's music or whatever it is. That would be my advice, is as soon as you hit that lucky moment of opportunity meets something that you love doing, just go for it and don't think about it. I strongly believe that you can always change what you're doing and what path you're on. But if you don't commit to anything, I don't think you'll actually ever be successful.
Gotcha. Very fair. So, all right, my next question for you is, let's see, I feel like you're maybe my 161st or 62nd interview.
Okay.
Yeah, doing a good number here. But you're somewhere between my first and second, let's say, financial ops person, third at the most. Mm-hmm. So I don't think anyone's listening to all 162. But right, who's listening to this interview made this far? Someone who might be interested in, like, yeah, I'm a corporation, I'm in finance too. Maybe the fact that you're working in a creative type atmosphere could have real appeal as well. So for, let's say, someone who is interested, not so much working at your company, but in that sort of career, what specific advice do you have for them?
That's interesting in moving to more finance career from music.
Yeah. So when he's thinking about that sort of finance, you know, can I call you in-house finance as opposed to, you know, working at a brokerage, right?
Sure.
Sure. And that you're also handling like the business operations side, you know, office manager plus, 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 plus.
Yeah.
So I mean, if someone who says like, hey, this is like a really cool career, this is really interesting, I'd love to get into something like that, what advice do you have for someone who's thinking that?
Oh, honestly, Kevin, I don't think my story is a really great example. I think I got lucky. I fell into something and I worked really hard. I think opportunity is really hard to find. So to a person like that, I mean, I'd say to look for those opportunities, but if you want to make them, unfortunately, it seems like the easiest path to find opportunities in finance is more school. And at least that's kind of what I've heard. If it was me, I wouldn't do it. I don't want to go to coming right from Berkeley. I definitely did not want more schooling.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of, it's tough. It's tough for me to give advice on that sort of thing, because I feel like I have such a outlier of a story.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm thinking now of, I spoke with someone who's a principal at a venture capital fund, and he also had a very unusual, very random story.
Yeah.
So, you're right.
I guess it happens.
Yeah. And as you said before, when you do get an opportunity, you really give it your all.
Yeah. Yeah, because they're rare.
Sure, sure. No, I totally understood kind of how I ended up at Berkeley. So, they hired me initially as a part-time instructor to teach one class, because the previous professor had quit 2 weeks before the spring semester.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. And, so now you're full time.
I've been promoted twice and converted to full time.
Oh, good for you.
But that was oh my god, this is the big break. I bet I got to, you know, do it right, like you were saying.
Right. Right.
Very cool. So, all right, Adam, just have one last question for you. Which is, you have the mic. Is there anything we missed? Anything else you'd like to say?
No. I kind of summed up my feelings on a bunch of stuff.
Right.
It's bottomless opportunity. That's it. That's life.
Well, in that case, it was very, very interesting, your path. Thank you very much for sharing it.
Thanks, Kevin.
Hey, I really enjoyed this conversation. So look for a message from me in the near future, and best of luck with everything.
Great. Thank you, Kevin. Have a great night.
You too. Bye now.